Chapter 67. Ross Locked Up. For the first 2 weeks after his arrest, inmate number ULW981 was locked up in solitary confinement at a jail in Oakland, California. His street clothes were taken away, exchanged for a red prison jumpsuit with Alameda County Jail written across the back. His shoes were swapped out for a pair of socks and flip-flops. His wrists were shackled to a chain around his waist. He was allowed outside for 1 hour a day as he waited to be transported to New York City, where he would hear the charges against him and stand trial. The news of his arrest was like an atom splitting on the internet. Thousands of blogs, newspapers, and TV outlets covered the story of the Boy Scout who had secretly been running a website that, the FBI alleged, had trafficked $1.2 billion in drugs, weapons, and poisons in just a couple of years. For those who knew Ross, the story and his arrest just didn't add up. His friends and family believed that it was one giant mistake. When a reporter called his best friend, Renee, whom Ross had stayed with on Hickory Street in San Francisco, asking what he knew about Ross's involvement in the Silk Road, Renee was so flabbergasted and confused that he said, "I don't know how they messed it up, and I don't know how they got Ross wrapped into this, but I'm sure it's not him." When Ross's family found out, they felt the same way. There was just no way that Ross could be involved in such a site. Cousins, aunts, and uncles, and his siblings were sure that he had been framed, that the truth would set him free. On Facebook, elementary school chums, high school buddies, and old neighbors shared links in disbelief, shocked by what they read. "There's no way. Not in a million years. Not Ross." In San Francisco, one of the men whom Ross had lived with on 15th Avenue was walking to work and stopped to pick up a copy of the San Francisco Examiner. On the front page of the paper, above the fold, there was a picture of Ross smiling next to a screenshot of the Silk Road. The roommate snapped a photo of the front page with his smartphone and then sent it to the other renter in the 15th Avenue apartment. "Funny," he wrote in the text message. "Looks kinda like our subletter, Josh." "Not looks like," the other roommate replied. "Is." Holy shit. And then there was Julia, who had planned to video chat with Ross the night he was arrested. She had stripped down to her sexy lingerie and logged on to Skype, hoping to see a handsome Ross staring back at her through his laptop camera. But he never showed up. She rang and rang, trying to reach him, but no one answered. She was completely unaware that at that very moment, the man she hoped to flirt with through a tiny little camera on her computer was sitting in handcuffs in a jail cell, and that his laptop was being probed in an FBI forensic truck by two federal agents. Eventually, she gave up trying to call him that evening, assuming that Ross had forgotten about their online assignation, and she went to bed alone. The next morning, a client came into her office, and as they sat going through photos, Julia's cell phone rang, interrupting the meeting. It was a friend from Austin who simply uttered the words, "Google Ross Ulbricht." "Huh?" Julia queried. "Just do it," the friend demanded. "Google Ross Ulbricht's name." Julia turned to her computer, typed in a name she had written 10,000 times before, and waited for the results to load on her screen. When she saw the news, she almost fainted. Shock took over her body as she fell on the floor and began wailing. 2 weeks later, Ross boarded a flight on Con Air, a nickname given to the prison airline that transports inmates, to New York City. When he landed, after an arduous zigzag across the country, picking up and dropping off other prisoners, Ross was placed into the general population in a Brooklyn jail where he would live until his trial began. His devastated parents flew up from Austin to see him. Friends made the pilgrimage to show their support, and Ross met his new lawyer, Joshua Dratel, a stalwart attorney who was known for defending some of the most notorious criminals on American soil, including two men who were involved with the U.S. embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania that killed 224 people. Ross had chosen Dratel because he saw him as a lawyer who subscribed to the philosophy that someone's beliefs shouldn't be a crime, and that the system should offer everyone, even alleged terrorists, a fair trial. The FBI had tried to find the bodies of the people murdered on the site, the ones DPR had paid to have killed, but no database matched the crimes. It appeared that either the Hell's Angels had disposed of the bodies perfectly, or, more than likely, no one had actually been killed at all. Rather, the Dread Pirate Roberts had been scammed for hundreds of thousands of dollars. The government offered Ross a plea deal of 10 years to life, but he wasn't willing to take the chance of a judge handing down the latter of those two sentences. Ross still very much believed that he could get himself out of this. He declined the offer. In response and in frustration, the U.S. Attorney's Office decided to throw everything it had at Ross and to make an example of him. What Ross didn't know at the time was that the laptop the FBI had managed to slip out of his hands had not been as secure as he hoped. Ross's booby traps had failed, and his password, Purple Orange Beach, had too, as the FBI team managed to find the password hidden in the computer's RAM. The forensics team had uncovered a trove of digital evidence, including Ross's diary entries, Silk Road financial spreadsheets, and, worst of all for Ross, some documents that Ross didn't even know were on the machine, including millions and millions of words of chat logs among DPR and his cohorts Knob, Smedley, and good old Variety Jones. After turning down the plea deal, Ross was officially charged with 7 felonies. Count 1 against him was narcotics trafficking, which, he was told, could result in a sentence of 10 years to life. Count 2 was distribution of narcotics by means of the Internet, which could also result in 10 years to life. 3 was narcotics trafficking conspiracy, 10 to life. Count 4 was the most terrifying, even for Ross, a charge of running a continual criminal enterprise. This was known as the Kingpin Statute, and was reserved for the big boss of an organized criminal enterprise. While the Kingpin charge carried a minimum of 20 years in jail and a maximum of life, if it was proved that the Kingpin had murdered someone, the sentence could be upgraded to death. Finally, there were counts 5 through 7, where Ross was charged with computer hacking, money laundering, and trafficking in fake IDs and false documents. If he was found guilty, these could tack another 40 years onto his sentence. It was a hefty and sickening list of charges. While Dratel assured him that they were going to come up with a plan for his defense, the severity of the situation started to sink in for Ross. Thankfully, there was some respite from all this bad news. Julia was going to fly out to New York to visit. When they saw each other for the first time, they both wept. "I told you, Ross," she said. "I told you." He knew exactly what she was talking about, without her actually saying the words. Then she asked Ross if he would read the Lord's Prayer with her. The scruffy boy she had met years earlier at a drum circle, now sitting in his prison uniform, said he would be happy to. He knew he needed all the help he could get. She uncrumpled a piece of paper and began reading. "Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name." Ross remembered the words from his childhood in church and recited along in tandem. His voice followed a few breaths behind Julia's. And then they came to the end of the prayer, and he said the last sentence aloud. "And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil." Afterward, Julia handed Ross a couple of dollars to go to the soda machine, and she slipped the prayer in between the bills she placed in his hand. Julia, it seemed, still wanted to save Ross, even though she now knew he could no longer save her.